What does the invention of paper money in Europe have to do with the future of cryptocurrency? Stay tuned to this podcast to explore the connection.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have an extra special guest. His name is Paul Krugman, and you probably know him from his ubiquitous New York Times columns. If you don't know him from that, you must know him from television, from all of his books, including his textbooks. He was the 2008 winner of the Nobel Prize, as well as just too many honorifics to list. If you are remotely interested in any of the following: economics, income inequality, climate change, the history of economic development and thought, how public policy affects the population, healthcare law, climate change law, go down the list. We just wonk out on everything, and it's just an absolutely fascinating conversation. So with no further ado, my MIB interview with Paul Krugman.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My extra special guest today is Paul Krugman. He is the winner of the 2008 Nobel Memorial Prize for his contributions to new trade theory and new economic geography. He is a distinguished professor at the CUNY Graduate Center of the City of New York. He spent much of his career teaching at MIT and Princeton, where he focused on economics. He has either authored or edited 27 books, published over 200 scholarly articles. Most recently, his book, Arguing with Zombies, Economics, Politics, and a Fight for a Better Future, just came out. He is the second most cited author on the college syllabi for economics and is perhaps best known as a columnist for the New York Times. Paul Krugman, welcome back to Bloomberg.
Hi there.
It's good to see you again. Let's jump right into this. So I recall you telling a story that you were a science fiction geek as a kid. How did Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy lead you to economics?
Isaac Asimov wrote this, you know, these books, I think it's 1940 or thereabouts, which are, you know, it's the Galactic Empire and people use blasters and have spaceships, but actually, the science fiction-y part is the least of it. It's social science fiction. The core of the story is there's this group of mathematical social scientists, the psychohistorians, who have figured out that galactic civilization is falling and have discovered that if they intervene in just the right way, they can limit the period of barbarism. So it's basically social scientists save the universe. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be one of those guys, and economics was as close as I could get.
That's pretty amusing. People may not know that you are an economics textbook author. You and your wife wrote what is today the second most popular economics textbook in colleges today. Who's the lead? Is that Mankiw?
Yeah, I'm afraid it's Greg Mankiw.
So whatever led you to write a textbook? That sounds like a lot of work.
Actually, yeah. So the first thing about it is that nobody writes one of those principles books except out of ignorance of how much work it's going to involve. Mm-hmm. The labor that's involved in producing, especially the first edition, but even the revisions, is enormous. Partly it's a reasonably honest way to make a living.
Teaching is not?
Well, it's supplemental. So since my wife is my co-author, our in-house name for the book is Economics 401k.
That's funny.
But it was also, we thought we could have a different kind of textbook, that most students come up thinking economics is this totally dry subject. And, you know, some of it is. I've got to admit that. But there's stories. So we thought we could try to write a textbook which was as much as possible story-driven. It was about real-world things, and then we say, here's how economics helps you make sense of these things. And so we wrote a textbook that was different, and a lot of people like it.
And you were still doing the revisions on the textbook while you were in Stockholm for the Nobel Prize? Is that true?
That was second edition. And the financial crisis broke as we were going through pages. So we already were in galleys. And suddenly nothing in the money and banking chapter was true anymore. And so we were frantically working to revise that chapter in pages. So every replacement passage had to exactly physically fill the space of the stuff it replaced. So yeah, I had a lot of stuff I had to do in Stockholm. Robin spent a large part of the time on the floor of our hotel room crawling from one set of papers to another doing the revisions. That was insane.
You had written, or maybe I read it in an interview about a decade ago, that at the top of the dot-com bubble, you said, gee, the stock market doesn't make any more sense. I'm going to pull out of equities. Was that true? And that, B, how did you?
That was true then. We have, in fact, gotten back in some. Still, I think probably our portfolio is less equity heavy than probably the average. But
well, 20 years ago, you were what, early 50s, late 40s?
No, 20 years ago, I was late 40s.
Late 40s. So you should have equities then, and now less equities.
Yeah. So, I don't claim to be a great investor. In fact, Robin's got the better head for detail, which is important. So we own a lot of selective real estate, not the things mm-hmm. where we think we know something.
Okay. Well, real estate goes up over time as well. So wait, when you say you've partially gotten back in, does that mean you're some stocks, some bonds, some real estate?
Yeah.
So you have a diversified
portfolio. We have a
portfolio.
Diversified portfolio.
That makes a whole lot of sense. There's another issue I have to ask you about, which is that of media bias. Lots of people these days have accused the media of being fake news or biased or whatever. You take a decidedly different perspective on bias. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the biggest. So by and large, the media get facts right. The formal media. I mean, that's not obviously true of Breitbart or something like that. But the New York Times gets its facts right.
Mm-hmm.
What it doesn't do very well is it doesn't know how to handle things where there really aren't two sides to a debate. When there's one of the very first columns I wrote back during the 2000 election said that if Bush had said that the Earth was flat, the headline would probably read "Views differ on shape of the planet." Right? The media are really terrible, and that's very hard to. That's a real problem when you have not just a highly polarized political environment, but an asymmetrically polarized political environment where one side of the debate is peddling zombie lies, and the other is not, and so it's very there's a real failure, I think, to inform. There's a unwillingness to. I mean, when I started out, I was literally forbidden to use the word lie in my columns,
mm-hmm.
and that's no longer true. But even so, there's a tremendous bias towards even-handedness, even when the hands are not remotely even.
So you get this false equivalence where both sides are treated equally. The other thing that you have referenced as a form of bias that I've always been amused by is the concept of, quote, very serious people.
That's right.
What are the very serious people?
So very serious people, the phrase actually, a lot of it comes from the buildup to the Iraq War when all the serious people thought this was a good idea, which it wasn't, obviously. But very serious people are people who buy into what is a conventional wisdom of the time, something that important people say, and everybody thinks it's serious because all of the other serious people are saying it, and
they all nod their head in
that's
no
right.
agreement.
The U.S. debt levels are a major threat, even though that's not really true. Or we have a real problem of a skills gap in the workforce, so these are things. I stole it. I think I stole it from the blogger Etrios, but it really works. These things that – and that's, by the way, where the media drops its even-handedness on this. So a lot of reporting on debt, it was uncritically, Bowles and Simpson are great national heroes.
Who?
Yeah, remember
right?
that? But the whole – so it's funny that the one place where the news media really dropped the false equivalence and start saying one side is right is, in fact, where that side happens to be wrong.
But they're very impressed by titles and by positions and by some academic credentials. And if you're the head of a think tank, they think you're actually thinking when really you're not thinking.
Well, they are impressed by think tanks, which is really a bad idea because there are think tanks and then there are think tanks. And a lot of the think tanks don't actually think. They're very impressed by rich people, powerful people. Mm-hmm. So if you're, you know, if Jamie Dimon says we have a skills gap, that must be serious. Whereas, you know, Jamie Dimon is no doubt a great business person, but he doesn't know anything about macroeconomics. So it is a real problem. On many issues, going to important people is absolutely the worst place to get information because they're people who have a stake in a particular point of view, and or they're too busy to actually think hard. So it is a, you know, those are the places. Now it's gotten better, I have to say. The Times now has several people writing who actually do understand some economics, don't uncritically accept stuff. We've got a whole section, The Upshot, which tends to be analytical pieces from multiple disciplines. So it's better than it was, but still. Those are the biases. It's not liberal bias. It's not even actually conservative bias. So there does very serious people tend to be somewhat right of center, but it's mostly seriousness and even handedness on things which are in fact not serious and in fact where you shouldn't be treating both sides equally.
Let's talk a little bit about free trade, which is what you won your Nobel for. Free trade has been the cornerstone of U.S. economic policy. Why has it gotten such a bad reputation amongst some economists and a lot of people in this administration?
Economists love free trade for some good reasons and some not so good reasons. We love free trade because, in fact, there's a lot to be said for it. It's particularly important, really, for smaller, poorer countries. Try and think about what would happen to Bangladesh without the ability to export clothing. It would probably literally be starving to death. So trade, open markets, doesn't have to be precisely free trade, but open markets are really important for a lot of the world. It's always been the case that if you did it right, you understood that while free trade generally makes all countries richer, it doesn't make everybody within the countries richer. It has effects, possibly strong effects on the distribution of income. Now, we tried to quantify that a little bit, and there's no question that it's a growing world trade has been a source. Nowhere near the dominant source, but a source of rising inequality within the U.S. What we really missed, and which has been where a lot of the academic research has gotten, we missed how concentrated the negative effects are. Right. So you take a look and you say, look, okay, we're importing a lot of stuff from China that we didn't used to import. One of the things is furniture. So we're importing lots of furniture from China.
Furniture, clothing,
but
toys.
I like furniture as a particular example because if you ask, all right, how many jobs were displaced by imports of Chinese furniture?
50,
the answer 000? Is maybe probably more than 100,000.
Okay.
Maybe even 200,000. But, you know, the other jobs were created, lower price to consumers. How big a deal is that? Well, if you happen to be in Hickory, North Carolina, which is a city that is built entirely around the furniture industry, all of a sudden for that community, it's a devastating impact.
Sure.
So we missed the extent to which the U.S. economy is gigantic and it's churning all the time. 1.5 million people are fired every month. So you say, how much difference can this trade make? Well, the trouble is that the impacts of trade have tended to fall quite heavily on specific communities. And mea culpa, I didn't see that. And it really took a very good paper published in 2013, I think, on the China shock, that among other things, written by one of my students, and to point out how much we were missing that effect.
So lots of countries have an industrial policy. Shouldn't there be some sort of, hey, if you're in West Virginia coal country or in North Carolina furniture country, or in the broad loom and fabric areas that are specifics to certain states, when it's apparent that a region is getting decimated because of global trade advantages, where essentially global labor arbitrage and some of the improved technologies that become specific to elsewhere in the world, why don't we do a retrain, reeducate, give people new skills so they can compete even if it's no longer in coal or furniture?
Well, we try. And we've had trade adjustment assistance at various points in our history. It's never been tremendously successful. And by the way, trade is not unique. You know, technology does it. If you actually want to ask what happened to West Virginia, international trade, it turns out, is not an important thing for West Virginia. It's changes in the technology.
Fracking.
And even before fracking, it was mountaintop removal. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, instead of employing thousands of workers to mine coal, you just blow the tops off mountains and use some
machines.
There
it is. Right.
So now you can't have a policy to – or it's hard to have a policy to deal with every shock. What you really want is a strong safety net. So that at least some basics are supplies, so at least people have the resources, among other things, the resources to move or seek different jobs, whatever. The little secret of American policy is that we actually have a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have, because the major social programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, are paid for at the federal level mostly, because the tax system is at least the federal tax system is fairly progressive, we actually end up providing a lot of de facto aid to distressed regions. So you take Kentucky, it's receiving net aid from the federal government to the tune of about 20% of GDP.
Wow.
So, you know, we actually do a lot. Now, that doesn't, it's not clear that we have anything that can, we can replace a fair bit of the income that's lost. We can't replace the dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it's not clear that anyone knows how to do that.
Another thing that's kind of interesting that you've written, quote, international trade and trade policy aren't nearly as important as people think they are.
People love to go on about international trade because of a variety of reasons, but among other things, it sounds important. It's international. It's global. My parents once gave me a sweatshirt that said Global Schmobile on it. I said, what? And they said, every time you go off to a conference, we ask you what it's about, you say Global Schmobile. You know, people love to talk global. Which means that we exaggerate. You know, compare, we spend about the same share of our income on imports and on healthcare as a nation. Trade, even with the Trump tariffs, trade is sort of only, it's mostly actually pretty clean. Healthcare is a howling mess.
Right.
So healthcare policy is much, much more important than trade policy. But that's not reflected in the way we talk about the world.
So let's talk about changes to some of the trade policy. We had, I recall Ross Perot talking about the great sucking sound that NAFTA was going to create, pulling all those jobs south of the border. Trump effectively ran on that, and now we've tossed aside NAFTA with USMCA. We're all so much better now, aren't we?
Right. So people I know have been calling USMCA the Village People Agreement.
Right.
And it's USMCA is basically NAFTA with Trump's name stuck on it.
Is it not all that different than what?
It's 95% of it is just the same thing as before. And there's a few other things. The one place where there's some significant difference is it actually gives a little bit more protection clout to labor unions, which is why Democrats voted for it.
In the U.S.?
In the U.S.
Really?
In Mexico, too. But it was kind of a pro-labor union change in policy. Not big deal, but enough so that Richard Trumka of the AFL-CIO said, you know, vote for this, and the Democratic caucus voted it through because there was something in it for organized labor, which I'm sure was not – I'm not sure whether that was, you know, over Trump kicking and screaming or whether he just didn't even know that he'd done that. But anyway,
He's quite the policy wonk.
Right. So he knows, unlike everybody else, that Kansas City is in Kansas.
Post-Super Bowl, congratulations.
Yeah, yeah.
That was pretty. So a few people pointed out that it's actually in Missouri.
Yeah, well, kind of people in Missouri kind of noticed that.
Let's talk a little bit about your book, which I found quite intriguing, filled with all sorts of fascinating topics. Let's begin with the Great Financial Crisis. You had some very prescient columns in 05 and 07, running out of bubbles, that hissing sound coming out of real estate, and innovating our way to financial crisis. All of these predate 2008. What were you looking at that gave you such a clear view of the financial crisis that was coming?
It was just clear that on the normal metrics, things like the prices to rents, that housing had gone way out of sight.
Right.
And you just said, is there a good reason for this? There were the kind of the telltale informal signs. You know, if the dot-com bubble, I thought I had an inkling that things were going to be bad when I realized that when you went into a bar, They tended to have CNBC on in the bar instead of sports. And then
I have a very vivid recollection of that era where stocks became the national pastime.
Right. And then so if you go back to around 2005, it was shows like Flip This House.
Right.
So it was the same kind of feel to it. So it just looked way out of whack. And I had an inkling, but only a partial inkling, that the financial sector was out of control, that we didn't know what we were doing, that things had gotten complicated. It was only when the crisis was in full swing that it became clear that we were in much worse shape than I'd realized, that more than half of the banking sector was things that weren't called banks and therefore weren't regulated like banks. And then, so shadow banking was a huge vulnerability. But that was one of the few times when it really seemed obvious that something was majorly out of whack and that something bad was going to happen.
So let's fast forward a couple of years. During the second Bush term, you had been staunchly opposed to privatizing Social Security. And you wrote, quote, "An amazing thing happened. For the first time since I became a New York Times columnist in 2000, my side of a policy debate actually won."
Yeah.
How is that possible that, you know, for 10 years you're not winning any debates despite making pretty good arguments?
Well, if good arguments won, then the world would be a very different place from the way it is. And look, I started writing during the 2000 election, and obviously—
For the Times.
Yes.
Because you had been publishing at Slate for a good couple of years.
Yeah,
that,
and
right?
Fortune as well. So, but for writing for the Times, I only got really political during the 2000 election because it was obvious to me that then-candidate George W. Bush was lying through his teeth about his policies. But the— So it was a period of Republican ascendancy, and the Republican Party already then, although not as much now, was dominated by zombie ideas, by beliefs in the magical power of tax cuts and so on. So I was on the losing side of most of the political stuff, and it wasn't—
Wait, are you telling me you don't believe the Laffer curve is a real—
Oh, I believe that there is a Laffer curve, and there is some tax rate beyond which you actually lose revenue. But I suspect that that tax rate is on the order of 80% or—
Right.
No, I suspect. I actually estimate that the Laffer curve is not relevant for the U.S. economy. And yeah, so between the fact that you have a very powerful right wing, which is committed to things that are not true, and the fact that the very serious people—
Mm-hmm.
—tend to go for things that are serious but not actually serious.
So let's talk about a very serious person that you seem to have a constant ongoing argument with, Paul Ryan. You have a section called Fiscal Phonies. You—
Yeah.
—specifically point out Paul Ryan. I have a problem with a group I call the deficit chicken hawks. They're chicken hawks. They're big deficit hawks as long as they're out of power. Once they get into power, suddenly the deficit doesn't matter. What's your beef with Paul Ryan?
Well, it wasn't really with him. I mean, in fact, I'm not a— you know me personally. I'm not a person that's particularly, you know, into grudges, personal feuds, whatever. I don't. But Paul Ryan was a symbol both of where the Republican Party has gone, but also of what's wrong with media coverage. I mean, the media equivalents required that there be serious, honest conservatives, the people who are really earnest, had interesting ideas. So there was a role that someone had to fill, except there actually is nobody like that. So they promoted Paul Ryan into that role because he pretended to be that kind of person. Not actually very good imitation. It was pretty obvious if you took even a few minutes reading his stuff that he was a phony, but that wasn't what people wanted to hear. So I was out there, you know, years ahead of almost anybody else, saying, "Hey, this guy that you're claiming it to be the intellectual leader of the Republican Party is a flat out phony and an obvious one, and actually a pretty clumsy one." So I returned to him as an example both of where the GOP has gone and how the media can go wrong.
So you said, "I know you personally, and I want to put a little color on that. I probably know you pretty well for—is it a decade?"
Probably.
It was before the financial crisis.
It's more than a decade.
So it's more than a decade. But the thing that I find fascinating about you—and full disclosure, we have these monthly salons. We go to dinner. I see you pretty regularly. I think that something I wrote was the subject of your very first blog post at Conscious of a Liberal. You'd since backfilled, so it's hard to judge.
I can't tell.
But I recall seeing that and posting it and saying, "Oh, look, Paul Krugman is blogging." I'm fascinated by your public persona and how what people think of you because of your columns is nothing like what you're like in the real world. You're a very different person in the real world, in reality, than I think what people see in terms of your columns.
Yeah, I'm a pussycat. I mean, I'm quiet, shy, not at all. You know, I'm not a very angry person or any of those.
Not at all. You're optimistic. You're upbeat. You're funny. People don't realize you have a sense of humor. Sometimes a sharp sense of humor, but still, I don't know if I would use the phrase happy-go-lucky, but you're a pretty easygoing, happy person.
Yeah, it's
not your image.
Yeah, because people look and say, "Well, those are tough columns,"
angry.
Which they are.
He's angry.
Yeah, but I'm not angry. I'm just realistic. Sometimes I'm angry, but it's a policy anger. It's about how we handle the world, person to person. I'm mild mannered Clark Kent or something.
Okay, that's pretty fair, Clark Kent. And one of the things that I find fascinating is that you're much more right than wrong. I don't mean right versus left, but on a lot of things you've discussed, broad policy issues, the result of certain things, you've been pretty dead on everything. On the rare occasions where you get something wrong, people like jump on it and beat on it. But I always want to say, hey, that's the exception that proves the rule. If you have to, my favorite example is, if Trump gets elected, we're going to have a recession or the market's going to crash, something like that. People beat that drum constantly, and I always say, what else has he gotten wrong? It's hard to find broad pronouncements that are widely applicable that you weren't.
And I retracted that call 3 days later.
Right. No one wants to talk about that.
Yeah. I retracted that call and said that Trump was going to run bigger deficits. That was probably going to provide some stimulus.
And he has, and it has.
Yeah. So, well, but that's part of why do zombie ideas persist? Well, because there's a network, there's money behind it. I mean, there used to be a guy at National Review whose full-time job was basically to stalk me, he wrote more blog posts attacking my columns than I wrote columns.
Right.
And so there's a whole industry. Now, they go after lots of people, but I seem to be a particular favorite. And there's...
That means because you're effective.
Well, it's a bit of a compliment. And, in terms of getting... Now, if you never make a mistake, if you never get something wrong, then you're not taking enough risks.
Right.
So, but of course, if you're in a position like mine where there are people, I am paranoid, but there are, in fact, also people out to get me.
That's the old line, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get
you. Right. So there are well-financed people out to get me.
And by the way, that might be Philip K. Dick, although I could be wrong, since I know you're a sci-fi buff.
I don't know. I don't remember whether he used that. But anyway, I think if you take it as a whole, in fact, look, the 5 years or so after the financial crisis were in a peculiar way. They were glory days because the models worked. People like me who had an updated, modernized, but still fundamentally Keynesian approach to things made predictions about what would happen to interest rates, to inflation, what the effects of austerity policies would be. That all came out right, and all the very serious people who said something different turned out to be wrong.
So hyperinflation didn't happen. Austerity would bring us out of our economic doldrums, especially in the UK.
Didn't
work. Basically, Keynes knew what he was talking about.
Yeah. I mean, Keynesians came in thinking that the multiplier, the impact on GDP of a $1 cut in government spending would be around 1.5. And after we had 5 years or so of hard evidence, it turns out that the multiplier is 1.5. I mean, it wasn't just the qualitative. Even the quantitative stuff was dead on.
Quite fascinating. I want to talk about politics because some of the reviews of this book and other books that you've written have described you as a political animal. But really, if you go back to the early history of Paul Krugman, Newsweek did a profile of you and called you ideologically colorblind. I think a lot of people don't know you worked in the Reagan White House.
Yeah, that was a sub-political level, just below. It was technocratic.
You staffer.
I was the senior international economic staffer at the Council of Economic Advisors.
Right, so no senior, Senate approval, no.
Right. Yeah, the senior domestic staffer was a guy, what was his name? Larry Summers. Don't know what happened to him. it was high level but technical position.
Right.
And I was a registered Democrat, as was Larry, but willing to work. And my job did not require that I be in public defending positions. And, of course, being at the Reagan administration, although Marty Feldstein, who was the chair of the council,
sure.
And who brought Larry and me down, although he was a—
Princeton, Marty Feldstein?
Harvard.
Harvard, okay, that's right.
Although he was a conservative. He was reasonable, and on any internal debate within the Reagan administration, I always was happy to back Marty's side of that debate.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was interesting. I mean, it was partially, I hope I did some good, but it was also a little bit of tourism. Got to see government from the
sure.
inside.
So that was a different era in conservatism. They seem to be a little more rational, fact-based?
Yeah, no, don't want to. There were a fair number of strange people, even in the Reagan administration. I mean, some of the people I dealt with, I dealt with economics people at the National Security Council who were crazy. And I thought, well, but this is not their real thing. I'm sure the actual security people are better.
Right.
And then along came Iran-Contra, and it turned out, no, they were all crazy. One of the things about where we are now is that each successive Republican president is managing to make his predecessor look good by comparison.
Right.
So,
right.
But it was
certainly looked better, at the very least.
So, but it was true that there was a lot more room for rationality then than there is now.
So most of your career, not a partisan, more of a technocrat. Your role is to provide policymakers with information about what did and didn't work. What changed? How did you flick a switch from being an ideological colorblind technocrat to someone who has been described as a hardcore partisan?
Well, two things happened. One is I changed jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So what you want to write if you're writing working papers and publishing in academic journals is very different from what you want to write if you're writing columns for the New York Times.
Right.
But also the world changed, and in particular the Republican Party changed. So the Republican Party of the 1980s was still a fairly diverse group, and while there were some voodoo economics types, and we were still to some degree in a space where we were having real arguments about real issues. Today, it's a monolithic. It's been completely taken over by zombies that have eaten the party's brains. So, actually, just saying things that are true. It's just saying, I'm not going to give credence to stuff that's obviously false is a partisan act. And since you're going to be doing that, you might as well try and make that case in a strong way and not pretend that you're having a serious argument when you aren't.
So once facts are no longer indisputable, once people can say what they want to believe, how can you have an intelligent debate about economic policy?
Well, across party lines, you can't. Not everything is party politics. If we want to talk about monetary policy, the Federal Reserve is still a zone of actual discussion and relatively non-politicized, although Trump is trying to put some very strange people on the Federal Reserve Board right now.
Yeah, gold bugs and all sorts of wacky.
Yeah, so that may change. But for now, still, it's a place where you can have honest arguments. And, of course, within the Democratic Party, there's serious discussion. I mean, there's no question that there were real debates about the shape of stimulus or the TPP or whatever where mm-hmm. you were having. But it's true that half the political spectrum is just a complete dead zone for actual debate.
So let me switch gears with you and talk about something related to this that you wrote a New York Times Sunday Magazine article about, which is how did economists get it so wrong? So let me throw the question back to you. Why did the profession fail to anticipate the great financial crisis?
Okay. So that actually, at some level, prediction. Predictions are hard, especially about the future.
Sure.
And failing to see the financial crisis, I think that people should have seen the housing bubble because that seemed pretty obvious. But that's not the major sin. The major sin was that a substantial number of economists enthusiastically embraced financial deregulation before the crisis. And at least
for the decades before the crisis, going back to The repeal of Glass-Steagall and
much more than that. Yeah,
way even before that.
Yeah, and then post-crisis, many of them were extremely critical of fiscal stimulus, even though they should have known better. And what happened there? So this is academic economics, and to a large extent, what happened there was that. Look, there. Partly it's ideology. It was a kind of conservatism that the economics profession is kind of center-right on average.
Sure.
So there was something political about it. But it was also we have these beautiful models, the model of an efficient market, efficient financial market where asset prices are always right. Is gorgeous. It's aesthetically pleasing. It feels great to play with it. Happens not to be true, but. It's a huge lure for the profession. And then after the crisis, it turned out also that the years and years of railing against Keynesian economics as being too ad hoc and so on had led to a lot of people just not actually understanding. You know, if we'd had the financial crisis in 1970 instead of in 2008, we would have had a much better policy response because it was unfortunately the evolution of the economics profession in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s took us away from understanding what we needed to understand in the aftermath of 2008.
So let's talk about how where you physically were at different schools around the country impact your understanding of that. You describe this in that same column as the difference between saltwater and freshwater economists.
Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah, it's actually Bob Hall came up with that one. But it's a. It turns out that the places that sort of kept the memory of Keynes alive tended to be places like MIT and Yale and Princeton, and the places that forgot all about it tended to be places like Chicago and Minnesota and Carnegie. And so just so happens that places that I would say maintained a fairly realistic view of how macroeconomics works, that were willing to actually look at the facts and not insist on the perfection of their models, tended to be places that were on the coasts of the U.S. as opposed to in the middle.
So I'm going to throw a curveball at you. Berkeley clearly is a saltwater economics thesis. Where do you put Stanford and the Hoover Institute?
Oh, the Hoover Institute is a peculiar thing within Stanford. It's mm-hmm. it's an odd thing. It's not actually the and Stanford is a mix ideologically, and the Hoover is this independent entity really within it. So, yeah. So what can you say? But no, definitely. I mean Bernanke hired me at Princeton, and then actually promptly left for the Fed. But still, but Princeton was a hotbed of people who worried about Japan because we mm-hmm. thought that Japan's problems were a possible omen for the rest of us, and that turned out to be exactly right.
Can you stick around a bit? I have a ton more questions
for you.
Okay,
we can do that.
We have been speaking with Paul Krugman, professor at CUNY Graduate Center and author of the book Arguing with Zombies. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and come back for the podcast extras where we keep the tape rolling and continue discussing all things economics. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. Be sure and check out my weekly column on bloomberg.com/opinion. Follow me on Twitter @Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
The problem is that money doesn't travel on the internet natively, and there's no standard for money to move natively, digitally, on the internet, globally, the way that it should.
This is David Marcus. David's the former president of PayPal and the current CEO of Lightspark, an internet payments operator.
It's insane. I mean, it's like literally moving money like it moved in the 70s.
Could cryptocurrency payments be about to catch on, becoming the digital standard? To make an educated guess about that, it turns out we need to look back to England in the 1600s, when paper money was invented in Europe. To explore more, listen to Evolving Money from Coinbase and Bloomberg Media Studios, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the podcast. Paul, thank you so much for doing this. I've been looking forward to discussing your new book, which I have right here, and just talking about so many other things. How goes the book slog? I know it's a slog.
Yeah, I'm just in the early stages. As we sit here, I've just done two events so far. Actually, Samantha Bee in New York.
She's so funny, isn't she?
Yeah, and then Mark Zandi in Philadelphia, who was not quite as funny, but was also really good. So
right. So Sam Bee, it's hard not to. When I did The Daily Show, she was the one who ran that segment.
Yeah.
And you just, so many takes ruined because she just makes you laugh. You can't not laugh.
No, we did. That was fine. And, yeah. But, I'm not a spring chicken anymore, so I'm not doing the crazy change cities every
not
day.
Not coast to coast?
Yeah, I'm not
See,
doing coast
See, you should
to
do
coast.
Bill Maher. He would have you on in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
Too far to fly.
Yeah. Although I'm actually, I'm doing London and Madrid. Because I'm big in Spain. For some very peculiar reason, I'm big in Spain.
Aren't you affiliated with London School of Economics also?
Yeah, but it's a very loose thing. But but they advertise my books on the sides of buses in Spain for some reason.
Really?
Yeah, and Spanish language edition came out the same day as the English edition.
So where are you going in Spain?
It's all going to be in Madrid, but even
right.
so.
So we were about two, maybe three Septembers ago, we were in San Sebastian. And it's in deep in the hinterlands of Spain, and it's just spectacular.
I've spent a fair bit of time in Santiago de Compostela, which is really great. The climate is really weird. The climate feels like Wales, and it's and they still take siestas. But there's a lot of great stuff. I've been around a fair bit of Spain.
They know how to live there. They know how to kick back, relax, enjoy food and wine. They're really it's a whole different headspace.
Yeah.
Paul, what do you think are the two most important zombies that you discuss in the book?
Oh, clearly it's the belief that tax cuts pay for themselves.
Wait, I thought they do. You're telling me they don't? Didn't the Laffer curve on that napkin say that you could cut taxes and they pay for themselves?
Yeah. Turns out we've had an erroneous napkin, and it has never once happened. So that's the one in terms of our political life
that
matters
is shocking.
Most.
I had no idea.
Yeah, and the other one is climate change denial.
It's a hoax. It's a Chinese hoax.
That's right. The belief that it's a hoax, or at least that it's not really serious, or anyway, there's nothing we can do about it. That's as the evidence keeps on piling in, and as the consequences start to show, the fact that that is still 60% of Republicans in Congress are climate deniers. They deny that climate change is happening at all.
The only major political party in the world with a majority that believes climate change isn't real.
Yeah, although I'm not entirely sure about the current governing party in Australia, but yes. But yes, this is those are enough to go on. There are other zombies out there, but those are the two really big ones.
Those are the big ones. Fascinating. All right, so let me jump through a couple of questions we missed during the broadcast portion. The two things I didn't get to that I thought were important were, well, let's start with climate change, a well-known Chinese hoax.
Right.
Climate change created by the Chinese so they could continue to dominate us on the industrial side. You call it, quote, an existential threat and a priority above health reform, income inequality, and financial crises.
Yeah.
That's a big statement.
Yeah, because if you make the planet unlivable or large portions of the planet unlivable, that, I was about to say, trumps everything else. So now that's
so
a word we kind of lost.
Right.
And that is, we're on track to really catastrophic outcomes. The climate models have been surprisingly accurate so far, and
there was just a big piece, I don't remember if it was Bloomberg or the Times, about I think it was Bloomberg, it was the 1988 forecast, turned out to be dead accurate.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is, it's good science, it's real science, and it's scary as hell. And the thing about it also as an issue is it happens to be something we know how to deal with. A mixture of public investment in new technologies plus putting a price on carbon, it would make an enormous difference. And technology is our friend here. Renewable technology has made enormous advances.
Prices
electrification.
Dropping. Sure.
So we all the ingredients are in place for solving this existential threat, except that we have the
you need leadership.
Well, we have leadership, which is trying to make sure that the catastrophe happens. So
what about a technological solution? So if we don't get a change in leadership, and 10 years from now we find ourselves with a rising global temperature and rising sea levels, what about seeding the clouds or some magic bullet that will make all this go away?
Well, you know, that's the last resort. I'm not going to rule it out. But there's enormous problems if you start to think about that, because anything you do that is actually geoengineering is going to have very uneven impacts. It's going to it may stop the planet from cooking, but it will cause worsening of the climate in some places. It'll be very uneven. So if you're upper lower Slavistan, and turns out that the United States and the European Union are planning a project of geoengineering that just happens as a small side effect is going to turn your country into a desert.
Right.
How are we going to deal with the political fallout of that? It's better than total doom, but it's really not the route we want to go down.
Have you been following the debate about climate change in Australia? It's quite fascinating.
Some of it. And they're
deep in denial. At least the elected officials seem
to be. The elected officials are. So it's a lot like our situation.
Like Florida.
Yeah. It's a place which is really on the as it happens, they happen to be right at sort of the leading edge of disaster. The continent is burning. But they have, like us, they have people who have an ideological opposition to any form of government action. They have powerful fossil fuel interests. And
huge mineral and timber interests that don't want to change.
Yeah. So, the Australia if you really want to feel depressed, look at Australia, where on the one hand you can see what the shape of things to come in terms of disaster, and you can also see politically how hard it is to do the right thing.
There's a wonderful book called Windfall, came out about 4 years ago, that traces the history of investment in climate change and new technology and all these things. And the conclusion of the book is essentially areas that are hot are going to get hotter, areas that are dry are going to get drier, areas that are cold are going to get colder, areas that are wet are going to get wetter. And it's not so much that the climate is going to change as it's just going to be so much more intense everywhere. Desertification is going to continue expanding. Places that suffer coastal flooding are going to be overwrought. It's whatever you have, just multiply times.
Well, I'm not sure it's that simple, but it's there's a lot of things. It's not linear. It's not just that every place gets 2 degrees warmer. It is that a lot of stuff happens in addition to that, and it's quite terrifying. And really, we. I talk in the book about zombie ideas.
Yep.
Fossil fuels is basically a zombie sector. We shouldn't be. We should be phasing out fossil fuels entirely quite quickly. And in fact, we have the technology to do that. If we had any kind of realistic pricing, we wouldn't be digging coal. We wouldn't be. We might be doing a
these
little bit of fracking.
These are every bit as subsidized as solar is.
More so at this point. At the moment, coal is losing the battle against solar and wind. Just on pure cost grounds, and you have the Trump administration trying desperately to force people to burn coal,
and the electric production facilities, all of the big plants that are making electricity, they're all moving to natural gas.
Yeah.
It's so much cheaper and cleaner.
Well, they're moving to natural gas and to and a lot of wind and solar and natural gas. Now, fracking is one of those things which there's a lot. It turns out we're releasing a lot of greenhouse gases because of lax regulation. But if we did it right, fracking is a good transition technology because hydrocarbons You know, methane has a lot less carbon per BTU than coal does.
Right.
So, and it's good for surge capacity. So, you know, we could, in a rational world, we'd be using a natural gas to provide surge capacity. We'd be using renewables to provide base capacity. Some nuclear, I'm okay with that. We would be getting it completely out of the coal business. We'd be shifting to electric vehicles. All of it. Fraction of a percent of GDP in terms of what it would actually do to growth, but of course not under current management.
Interesting. And then the other thing we didn't get to during the broadcast portion that I have to talk about, because you've written about it so much and it's such a giant issue, is the income and wealth inequality that's in our society. And I have to point out that back in 1992, you were first writing about this.
Yeah, I wasn't the first person to notice it, but it was already obvious. So I have a 1992 piece called "The Rich, the Right, and the Facts," which goes through, you know, a lot of the bad arguments that people were making against worrying about rising income inequality. All of those arguments, by the way, still being live because they're zombie ideas that won't go away. So yeah, this was now it's gotten substantially worse since then. You know, by modern standards, Gordon Gekko was a piker. This is definitely, and it colors everything. I mean, the fact that we have a society where a few people have so much money, so much influence, and also where people aren't living in the same universe. So we're socially divided, partly because we don't live at all in the same material universe, which is not the America I grew up in.
Right. So let's put some numbers, some flesh on the bone. You wrote, quote, CEOs now get paid more than 300 times as much as the average worker. So how did that come about? How was it formerly a 25X or a 30X to now 300X?
Yeah, that's actually quite an interesting story, right? Now CEOs have always pretty much appointed the people who decide how much that they'll be paid. So in some sense, it was always a game where CEO appoints some people who have every incentive to say, this guy is great, he needs to be paid an enormous amount. But they didn't used to exercise that power to anything like the extent that they do now. What changed? There was a big shift in power relations. It used to be that if you paid an extravagant sum, your union would kick up. And of course, the death of private sector unions has meant that that's gone away. It used to be that if you got yourself paid an enormous salary, the federal government would take a lot of it away in higher taxes. So at some level, if there was a question of, shall I piss off my entire workforce in order to be able to take home in order to get paid an extra $1 million? Well, if I'm only going to be able to take home $150,000 of that, I might not want to do it. If I can take home a much larger share of it, then maybe I will. So that changed. And then just a general set of norms, expectations. One thing that's clear, it's not because we have better CEOs. Right, it's
for sure.
It's really
the same pool. They're coming from the same schools.
Well, and look at how much money disastrous CEOs end up getting in their severance packages. Right,
so yeah, that's kind of surprising. It's really that sort of thing used to be. If you really screwed up, they would hand you your hat and send you on your way.
Yeah,
not with a $25 million exit package.
Yeah. 25 million, that's more than that. Anyway, but yes, so this is a real, this is one of the key pieces of evidence that says that if you think that technology and globalization explains why we've gotten so unequal, you know, explain to me how that means that incompetent CEOs get paid as much money as they get paid.
Doesn't. So there's a couple of bullet points that come from that. First, there's a fascinating Planet Money episode on the unintended consequences of some of the employment compensation changes under Clinton, Bill Clinton, that was part of a big set of tax changes, where they tried to cap the dollar payment and allowed payment in stock. How much of that is a source of this giant? Because when you look at stock compensation, it's the lion's share of these giant CEO comps.
Yeah, and it's whether that's the result of the policies enacted during the Clinton years, I don't know. It certainly is part of the issue, and there was a period when economists, some of them said, you know, good. We should pay people in stock because that gives them an incentive to perform well. But it turns out it doesn't actually work that way, partly because you get stock options, but they reset the price if the company does badly.
But aren't CEOs incentive to do a good job because they're the CEOs? You have to incentivize them more?
That's the point. It turns out, you know, back in the America I grew up in, again, I'm an old codger here, we had, you know, think about, you know, photos of, I always think of photos of NASA and the height of all of these guys in short sleeve white shirts
with the pocket protectors.
The pocket protectors, all of whom are being paid not all that well, none of whom have incentive pay, doing incredible things. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't, of course, we think of NASA, but the same thing was going on at the great technology companies at the time. So it's not it's amazing actually to think that I mean, money matters. Monetary incentives matter, but people do good work for lots of reasons, and we've lost the notion that people might do good work because they take some pride in their work.
Right. Also, it's their job, not to go too far on a limb. So you've described we're talking about climate change and denial there before. You've described quote the inequality denial industry, that either inequality wasn't rising or that it didn't matter. Who can legitimately, with a straight face, say there hasn't been a giant increase in economic inequality?
Well, you know, there's a good salary to be made from the ability to say that with a straight face, and that's really what drives it. But yeah, it's quite amazing. I mean, the numbers, the official numbers show it, although we actually have a problem with many of the standard measures because they don't actually keep track of gigantic incomes, because that's we didn't think we needed to, but now we do. There are people out there still trying to claim that inequality hasn't gone up much. And I just say, among other things, just, you know, walk around. Look at New York City. Look at the way we live now. It just is not the same middle class country it used to be. And then we do have, we have pretty sophisticated ways of between tax data, surveys, and so on, which
the Federal Reserve new data
series. Federal Reserve.
That's new. They never used to slice it as fine as they do. Top 1%, 10%. Half and
well, and
that's a big change.
The top 0.01%. Nobody ever thought that was important. How much money could there be up there? But the answer is now a lot.
Yeah.
And so yeah. So it this is not. There shouldn't be any real question about that. But again, it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it.
So let's talk about a headline from a different writer that I had to ask you about because it's so fascinating. Derek Thompson in The Atlantic. The weekend before we tape this, had a column, quote, this is the headline, "Boomers have socialism, why not millennials?" It's kind of a fascinating take.
Well, there is it is a peculiar thing that when people say, oh, America will never stand for government health insurance, every American 65 and older has government health insurance. When they say Americans won't stand for large government guarantees of income, Social Security. So we actually do have, in fact, the U.S. welfare state. It's not that – it's smaller than that of other advanced countries, but not that much smaller because, in fact, we do provide health care and retirement income to people over 65.
To people who vote.
It's probably the people who vote. But I think the other thing that happened was that, when Medicare came in why was it possible to go and provide government health insurance to everybody over 65? Why didn't people complain that this was taking away private insurance? The answer was that private insurers weren't interested in covering people over 65. There was never an
They're expensive.
Yeah, they're expensive and unpredictably expensive.
Right.
So you were basically moving into a blank space. And the trouble, the reason that it's not so easy to just have Medicare for all is that people under 65, many of them do have private health insurance, which both means that you have a lobby interest group, but I think even more important means that you're telling people, we're going to take away the insurance you now have and we're going to replace it with something different. Trust us, it'll be better.
Plus, and it probably, Plus death panels on top of it.
Plus death panels. And it probably will be better, in fact, but that's a really heavy political lift. And it's, I mean, if you can start with a tabula rasa, I dedicate this book to the Argument with Zombies to the memory of Uwe Reinhardt, a healthcare economist at Princeton who helped me a lot. And Uwe and his wife Mei Chung, they actually put together Taiwan's healthcare system, which is single payer. It's basically Medicare for all.
And how's it working?
It's working fine. But the Uwe himself said, "Look, we're not going to be able to do that in the United States. If you wanted to get there, I wouldn't start from here."
So we're recording this the day of the Iowa caucuses. Of all the Democrats who are running for office, who has the most compelling, workable health care proposal of everybody?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question because they're all workable proposals on the technicalities. Mm-hmm. Medicare for all would work. Elizabeth Warren has laid out a lot more detail about how it would be paid for than Bernie Sanders has, but something like that would work. Massively enhanced Obamacare, which is basically what Joe Biden
means, just extended to cover everybody and
so the subsidies don't cut off, so that we have much reduced copays, and it's just that also works. There are countries that have universal health coverage that do it through private insurance companies, like the mm-hmm. Netherlands. So that's also workable. I'm not sure that anyone, in terms of whose plan is. Actually, the truth is, I believe that if any Democrat is elected, what we will in fact get is Obamacare 2.0. Mm-hmm. That Medicare for all ain't going to happen, not for a few years anyway. And so, what we're actually going to get is something that is just a greatly enhanced version of what we managed to achieve in 2010, which is fine with me.
Right, and people have come to like Obamacare. In fact, the current administration, but for John McCain, would have gotten rid of it. I think that is certainly a factor in the outcome of the 2018 midterm elections.
It was probably the single biggest factor.
Really?
That's what most of it said. That was largely a healthcare election. One thing that worries me about Medicare for All and all that is that instead of people talking about the fact that Trump wants to take away what we have achieved, that they're going to be talking about some radical new proposal. And we need to keep focused because, if Trump is reelected, there's a very good chance that he will find a way to kill Obamacare in his second term.
So what do you think the outcome of November 2020 is going to be?
I personally have
no idea, although I will tee this up by saying it seems like 2016, he had a thread and needle quite precisely, and it was 150,000 votes across five states that put him over the top.
Yeah, and
has he gained votes or lost votes since then?
I don't know. We really don't know. I mean, it was also a media obsession with Hillary's emails and all of that. And Trump won in large part because nobody thought he could possibly win. He benefited enormously from coverage that ignored the possibility of his winning, and so it was okay to beat up on Hillary because obviously Trump can't win, and that won't happen, I hope, this time. But God knows. I mean, the economy is, unemployment is low, although what all of the political scientists say is that what matters is how fast is the economy growing, not the level but the rate of change in the year before the election.
2%?
2% is kind of borderline.
Right.
That's more or less neutral.
Right.
So, but who knows? I mean, Trump has certainly not managed to build mass support. He's become more popular over time.
His core group, he's still at whatever that is, 42%, 38%.
Yeah, and it's but Electoral College probably still gives him an advantage.
It looks like he's lost Pennsylvania already.
We hope.
And it looks like he's lost Michigan already, and
sure
possibly
Michigan.
Wisconsin.
Well, so, it is interesting that to the extent that Trump was making the Trump economy overall, I have to admit, it's a low unemployment economy.
It's the Obama economy extended out 4 years.
But it feels pretty, it
feels good.
It feels good. But the peculiar thing, the amazing thing actually, is that where Trump's economy is bad is precisely where he promised to help. So
farm bankruptcies
are way up. Manufacturing. We're in a manufacturing recession. So it's possible that tips the balance.
Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, that area.
So maybe But then on the third hand, there may be other factors coming in, and it's hard. I really have no ability to prognosticate on this stuff.
Two years ago, I would have bet you $1 million that the Senate would not change hands. And following 2018 and following the arc of all the news that's come out this year, I think it's a better than even chance that the Democrats take the Senate, or at the very least 50-50.
I think that's...
And that wasn't true 2 years
ago. No, that's clear. And it's in some
way... A bad map, a challenging, you know, it's only a third of the seats are up each. Everybody said, oh, 2022, maybe. But 2020, no chance.
No, it's a real chance now. That's one of those things that where there's enough, there are enough really weak Republican senators.
Yeah.
And it's, Arizona, you know, the places
Well,
where,
she was an appointee. She never won anything.
That's right.
So.
And is lacking pretty bad. Anyway, but I try not to.
Running against an astronaut, by the way, in Arizona.
Yeah. I try not to OD on this stuff too much. It's
easy to do.
The fact of the matter is that we don't know, but it's the realm of possibilities. I think do range from Trump victory and Republican Senate, probably still Democratic House, but to Democratic victory, Democratic sweep, and that would be really interesting. I mean, it would be, give us a chance to do. You know, Obama only had 2 years when he was actually able to do anything.
So did Trump. Only had 2 years.
Yeah, and so I think if we actually look at it, the possibility of another, you know, we're not going to get Medicare for all. We're not going to get
free college.
We might get a Green New Deal. Maybe not as big as the one that the advocates want, but I would definitely be for that. And but on the other hand, we may be on a slide into becoming an authoritarian one-party state. That has happened, and I'm really quite concerned that it could happen to us.
That would be bad if it happened. So on that cheerful note, because I know you are heading out to Seth Meyers from here, let's jump to our favorite question that we ask all of our guests. We call this the speed round. And I'll just plow through these as quickly as I can, and we'll send you on your way. Starting with, what are you watching these days? What are you streaming? What's your favorite podcast? What are you paying attention to?
Okay, I shouldn't say that. I don't really do podcasts. I very little. I am listening when I can to the Peterson Institute trade talks, which is that's professional listening.
Right.
How
about watching? What are you watching?
Oh,
Amazon Prime.
Amazon
Netflix.
Prime. I have both Amazon Prime and Netflix, and I watch all kinds of stuff, but mostly not. You know, nerdy stuff. So I'm a huge fan of The Expanse.
Oh God, I love that series.
Right. So
love
I think,
that.
And it makes me almost forgive Jeff Bezos for all the other things he's done that he rescued The Expanse and has continued.
This last season has been spectacular.
It's fabulous.
So good.
And actually, and something that social science nerds like as well, which is a whole other story. So that's,
and there's another season now coming in the future.
There's another season coming. There's also going to be. I don't know how many people saw this, but Altered Carbon, which was a Netflix, that was a great science fiction novel, and they turned into a great series, and there'll be a I think we're having a second season coming up next month. So
if you like Altered Carbon, you should check out Electric Dreams, which is loosely based on Philip K. Dick.
Which I haven't watched.
Really,
that one.
The first one is spectacular, and they're all separate. It's not a contiguous series. They're all standalone. So really, really interesting.
And I watch lots of concerts on YouTube.
That's right. You're a music geek.
Well, it's kind of weird. I'm a 66-year-old wannabe hipster. I watch a lot of indie music performances.
Right. Have you seen David Burns on Broadway, American Utopia?
No, I have not.
Oh, it's so amazing. I've seen it twice already. It's done February 16th, so you better go hurry up and see it. If you were Talking Heads,
we missed the window. Leaving
the country.
I'm going to be out of the country.
If you're a Talking Heads fan,
it's
amazing. It's really just amazing. A great show.
Too bad.
And did you see? You mentioned Amazon Prime. The Boys.
Haven't watched that yet.
So it's like the anti Marvel universe, like the opposite.
Okay.
When you look at the model there. Superheroes are part of a corrupt corporation that abuse their power to obtain government contracts It's just fascinating.
I probably should be into it because the whole superhero thing by and large leaves me cold. So
you would totally. So I only recommended this series to two people who could not be more different, you and Cliff Asness, and I'm betting both of you are going to love it.
Okay.
So put that down. Second, what's the most important thing we don't know about Paul Krugman?
Okay, so we have touched on this before. I think the most important thing that people don't know is that I'm a pussycat in person.
That's right. Your whole public persona.
The public persona somehow, even though I don't think I, you know, I don't
you don't actually, encourage it.
I don't encourage it. I don't insult. I don't talk about people's personal appearance.
But your writing is barbed and effective, and yeah. People interpret that as mean and angry.
Yeah, but I'm not angry, and I'm not a. I don't
You're
hold grudges.
Cat.
Yeah,
you're a mensch. Let's talk about your early mentors. Who influenced the way you look at the world of economics?
Okay, so I had two great economics mentors. First, Bill Nordhaus.
Oh, sure. MIT?
Yale.
Okay.
Nobel laureate, although yep. After me, which is kind of weird, but he got it. And I was his research assistant when I was still an undergraduate.
Wow.
And that was tremendous apprenticeship. And then Rudy Dornbusch at MIT was a huge influence on me and on the many students. So huge influence. So those are the two people, you know, whose personal advice, mentorship mentored a huge amount to
me. What about economists? What economists have influenced how you think of the field?
Yeah. So although I wasn't an advisor, but Bob Solow of MIT, a whole lot of the way I do economics, the whole writing style, which spills over to my public writing as well, comes a lot from Robert Solow, who was this great MIT economist who had this tremendous gift for taking complicated issues and turning them into simple models that illuminated the world. And I've always been in that. And then not a simple modeler, but John Maynard Keynes.
I was waiting for you to go there.
Maybe you have to actually do economics as an avocation to appreciate the greatness. Keynes's ability to think his way out of the box in which economists were trapped at the time and see things differently, there's never been anything like it. I would say not even Adam Smith did as much to really just say, this is the world is not the way you think it is. And it's an amazing performance.
Quite fascinating. Let's talk about books. What do you like to read for fun? What do you read? What do you recommend to people? Tell us some of your favorite books.
Okay, so I'm a geek, so I read a lot of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Anything by Charlie Strauss, who I consider the greatest living science fiction author.
Really?
Strauss. But lots of there we are. Actually, if you search, you can find I have met him.
The Atrocity Archives. Wow, some of these names.
The Laundry Files novels are amazing.
Really?
They are
The Annihilation Score.
Yeah. But he's incredibly prolific, and I had a memorable evening with him and several other science fiction authors who all live in Edinburgh, where we talked science fiction and tasted single malt scotches. And I describe it as a half memorable evening because I only remember the first half.
So give us some other books. He's interesting.
So, I mean, and in science fiction, actually, I just recently, for the first time in decades, reread Dune.
Oh, really?
Which
you know, there's a new version.
There's
going to
be a new version
coming out.
And, you know, previous ones, they've all screwed it up somehow.
Yeah.
But let's see, because that is actually an incredible book.
Yes.
The other thing I do is I read a lot of history.
Mm-hmm.
So all kinds of stuff. And I just read a long, detailed book on the Peninsular War, which is part of the Napoleonic Wars, but it's mm-hmm. the piece that where the Spaniards and the Portuguese, with help from the Duke of Wellington, were fighting the French in Spain. And it's what was great about that was that most of the stuff that you read about that in English is very Wellington-centered. It's very much about the British army. But this one gives you the whole panorama, which is much vaster and much more brutal.
The Peninsular War.
So right. It's really from 1808 up until 1813. There was this extraordinary very grim but fascinating struggle for control of Spain.
Give us one more, and then I'm going to ask you about one.
Okay, so favorite books. God, so many things. I mean, actually, I was very much influenced by, the philosophy of David Hume,
mm-hmm.
An inquiry concerning human understanding, about how skepticism and demanding evidence made a big difference. It was actually only years later that I realized that actually he probably was the first modern economist, even before Adam Smith.
Wow, so that's really quite fascinating. So back to science fiction. Two different people who are sci-fi geek friends,
yeah.
who I have a giant overlap with their taste. I respect what they like and don't like. When two people recommend a book, I go out and get it, but I haven't read it yet. Both recommended The Three-Body Problem.
Yeah.
Have you seen this?
I have read it.
Oh, you read it. What are your thoughts on it?
I mean, I liked it.
It's a full trilogy,
and it's kind of weird. I mean, it's Chinese.
Right.
Science fiction. And
yep.
It's very different in feel, and it's strange, but it's full of interesting ideas, and even some character development. You know, a lot of science fiction, I have to admit, the characters are kind of two dimensional. It's a little bit better than that with this, and it's not the best stuff I've read. I mean, I think maybe it may lose something in translation. I don't know.
Read it in the original Mandarin?
No, my Mandarin skills are a little bit limited.
So that's probably where it fell a little short. Speaking of fail, tell us about a time you failed and what you learned from the experience.
Oh, gosh. I mean, there have been multiples, but obviously I made a bad call about the economy on election night 2016.
Yeah, but didn't you roll that back pretty quickly?
3 days.
Okay, so
but
no one wants to hear about that. They just want to beat you with the original call.
But it is a reminder not to let and I'd done some things before. I mean, I was warning about a debt crisis during the Bush years, and it never happened. Usually when I make these things, I go back and ask myself, was that actually grounded in hard thinking, or was I letting my desire to see bad things happen to bad people influence
right.
my judgment? And that's usually what is the
case. Do you think Bush was a bad person, or was he just an amiable doofus in over his head?
I think he was not a great person. I mean, I think he...
But was he a bad person? If you had to pick Cheney or Bush...
Oh, no. Cheney was a bad person.
Okay, so Bush. When I look at Bush, I look at like, all right, I don't agree with most of his decisions, but he seems kind of like a goofy...
Well, utterly lacking in empathy for the people who are less fortunate than himself.
Okay.
So
that's fair.
That's fair. You know, so but not actively evil in the same way that Cheney was, and certainly not in the way that Trump is.
All right. So let's the failure is there. What do you do for fun? What do you do when you're not penning New York Times columns?
Well, I go to as many indie concerts as I can manage.
Tell us the last couple you saw.
Okay. Last two I saw were most recently, Reina del Cid, which is actually it's an indie band. It's also a person, but she's the core of it from Minneapolis.
Uh-huh.
Does sort of folky stuff, but really great fun. And I saw that at Rockwood Music Hall, which is a standing only venue. You stand there with a beer in your hand, and you're 5 feet from the band. So
right.
That was great.
You stood for 2 hours in front of the band.
I'm managing, as long as I can keep on doing it.
Yeah. All right.
And then
that's impressive.
And then the one before that was another Larkin Poe, which is blues.
Sure.
Uh-huh. They're two sisters from Atlanta, and they have a band. For touring, they have a band, and their records are just them plus various pieces.
They're like
of equipment.
A drummer and a guitarist, or a drummer and a bass player?
They add that, but the two of them are both one is slide guitar and one is regular guitar, and they do amazing harmony vocals, and that was just
they got
huge
hot
fun.
Recently, didn't they?
They got nominated for a Grammy.
A little bit,
they
yeah.
didn't win one, but they got nominated for a Grammy, and they and I saw them at Bowery Ballroom, which is 550 instead of 150 standing room
people. Yeah.
So these are all standing with a beer in your hand concerts.
Yeah, that's a tough gig. The last thing I did that for was U2 at the Garden, and that has to be 12 years ago. And I'm younger than you. I can't stand for 2 hours.
Well, so far so good. I mean, you know, there will come a time when I can't. Oh, and the other thing I do is I do bike trips now. I have actually done bike trips.
Like one the way. Full trip with the Chase van, and they're
yeah,
setting up
more
paths
or less.
For you, and
yeah.
they're saying go 2 hours this direction, and there's a pace vehicle and you're following.
Well,
and
not pace vehicle. There's a van that pops up with bottles of cold water every once in a while and takes your bags to the next hotel. And so I've been doing lately. I've been doing two of those a year. So
you're biking for 7 days, effectively.
Yeah, or actually for the next one, which is in Portugal, is going to be 10 days.
And your wife does this happily with you?
She actually has. The last couple, she's gone and done other things and met me at the end.
Okay.
But I have some buddies, all of them, you know, sort of my age, who are all of us, you know, still saying, hey, we can still do this. Let's do it.
And you could do that pretty easily in Europe. They're built for that more than we are.
Yeah, you want to go village to village. Although I've done them in Vermont. I've done them in Quebec. I've done, you know, it's a great way to get out of your head, right? Instead of worrying about the fate of the economy or the fate of it's just, can I actually get up that hill?
Right. Changes your focus. So speaking about worrying and being pessimistic or not, what are you most optimistic about these days and what are you most pessimistic?
Well, I'll start with the pessimism. I think there's basically an even chance that we're going to lose our democracy. You know, that's
50-50. 50-50.
Because
really?
even if we get past Trump,
the forces of populism have been unleashed, and that's
yeah. I mean, I for complicated reasons, I tracked the collapse of democracy in Hungary pretty closely,
uh-huh.
and you can easily see. I mean, if Trump was as smart as Viktor Orban, we'd have lost it already.
Right.
And so this is what really scares me most.
Right.
There's my pessimism. My optimism. You know, the Americans are just incredibly more open-minded than they were. It's partly young people. It's not just young people. I mean, when I think back to what the country was like in the early 1980s, I mean, and you can see it both. You can see it in polling, but in other things too. I mean, as an adult, a working economist, I lived in a country where only a third of white people thought interracial marriages were okay. A country where, I mean, as recently as 2004, gay marriage was a major election-losing issue, where just we had a closed-mindedness and prejudice level. And we've gotten vastly more tolerant, and that's got to be a good thing.
So the pushback to that is, hasn't the current administration revealed – I'm not saying they are this. I'm saying Trump has revealed there's still big streaks of anti-Semitism, racism, misogyny, much more in the United States than a naive upper-middle-class white guy like myself – would have guessed.
Yeah.
No one is anti-Semitic to me. How could it exist in the country?
You don't get my mail.
Oh, I used to get the blog comments. You and I have had conversations about how horrific some of the comments used to be. And I just chucked that up to, hey, people are getting killed in the financial crisis. No one wants to read me yammering about it, but they do. And then they would make a really obnoxious comment. That said, I didn't think that was – never extrapolated that to the rest of American society.
No, I think, though – but that stuff is always there, and that's
– But you think of it as a streak, as like, you know, a couple of outsider cranks.
No, it's –
It kind of feels like it's a little more expansive than it was.
I actually wrote something. It's not in Arguing with Zombies, but I wrote something early 2000s about about France, where the National Front had gotten a lot of votes in an election, and saying that there are angry people. That there's something like a quarter of the population in every advanced country who are all of these things, and that doesn't go away. The idea that we're
angry,
ever
disenfranchised, frustrated, and willing to express it in kicking the cat in any way they can.
Yeah, and does anybody and it's always the usual things. It's always about brown people. It's always I don't know if anybody listens to Tom Lehrer anymore, but he had a great satirical song from like 1961 about the choruses, the Protestants hate the Catholics hate the Protestants, and the Hindus hate the Muslims, and everybody hates the Jews.
Right.
And that's always there. But the point is that there was a sort of assumption that the majority of the population was like that, which was probably true in the 50s. And it's not it's a lot better now.
Mm-hmm. So just as economics advances one funeral at a time, does the Enlightenment of America advance one generation at a time? Is that what's going on?
Well, some. I mean, although there are plenty of horrible young people,
mm-hmm.
and plenty of pretty decent older people. So it's not that straightforward, but it's I think it is true that the younger generations are more tolerant than older generations. And on the other hand, you know, I grew up in the 60s, and I did watch lots of Age of Aquarius people turn into Wall Street traders. So that's not always the case that people—
Right. What's the old joke? You're heartless if you're not a socialist when you're young and a capitalist when you're older.
Anyone who is not a socialist under 30 has no heart. Anyone who's still a socialist after 30 has no head.
There you go.
That was the old line.
That's a great joke. So we're down to our last two questions. Speaking of young people, what sort of advice would you give a college graduate or millennial who was interested in exploring a career in economics?
Okay. So, first of all, do get the education.
Does that mean doctorate, or how far do you go?
Well, it depends on what you want to do. But you're going to need some kind of graduate degree to get entree into stuff. A master's in some cases is good enough, but you do need some certification. The thing I can say is do figure out what you're good at. And something that interests you, but not necessarily of cosmic importance. Figure out something that's really good and that you do well, and get that as a kind of a baseline. You can branch out. You can start to do stuff like writing newspaper columns or so on later on. But you do want to get that baseline. In fact, your contribution to society, by and large, basically the answer is don't try to be me. Not yet. I quote in Arguing with Zombies, I quote, there was an essay by Raymond Chandler on writing books. And he said, you know, that there have been some very dull books written about God and some very fine books written about making a living while staying fairly honest. So focus on where you can actually add.
I like that. And our final question, what do you know about the world of economics today that you wish you knew 30 or 40 years ago when you were first ramping up your career?
Oh, actually, see, the thing is, my career has been, the angels were smiling on me. I've had an optimal career. There's never been anything everything broke the right way for me in ways that there's, you know, just, I had no right to expect. So it's not that. There is now a major sort of scandal has pretty much come up in economics, where we're realizing just how strong the misogyny within the profession has been.
Oh,
just
really?
How badly how badly women have been treated, you know, not Harvey Weinstein level, but lots of discrimination.
Is this in terms of hiring or publishing or promotion?
Everything. Hiring, publishing, the way that they're treated in seminars, and of course then they, thanks to, we have, you know, anonymous social media, we know the way that some male economists talk about their female colleagues. And I was oblivious.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, maybe had some sense, but I didn't realize. I don't think I was ever doing it, but I wasn't campaigning to say, let's stop this. So I really wish that I had been more aware. I was sitting there comfortably, you know, in a super comfortable environment. I mean, I had all the qualifications. I had the right school. I was white. I was male. I was Jewish, which actually in economics in my generation was sort of normal.
Didn't hurt. Right.
And had no idea what a lot of people were going through. So I regret. If I had a better sense of what was really going on, maybe I could have contributed a little bit to making it better.
Huh. Interesting observation along those lines. Paul, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. We have been speaking with Paul Krugman, professor at CUNY Graduate School, as well as the author, most recently, of Arguing with Zombies. If you enjoy this conversation, well, be sure and look Up an Inch or Down an Inch on Apple iTunes, and you can see any of the 300-plus conversations we've had over the past 5-plus years. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. Give us a review on Apple iTunes. Check out my daily reads on ritholtz.com, my weekly column on bloomberg.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack staff that helps put together these conversations each week. Sam Shivraj is my producer. Michael Batnick is my head of research. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.